Hi, welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, coming to you from sunny Sydney, where I'm joined by Jason Wingrove, my normal partner over at the Red Centre podcast. But Jason, you're joining us today on the VFX show. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. I'm here in sunny Tarramurra, normally the highest rainfall in Sydney, but today, yes, I've got sun.
Well, I'm glad you're getting some. The great thing about this is we've got another Australian voice to balance out the two Americans that are joining us today. David Strapinis, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for
and
asking.
And it's presumably like, what, 9 or 10 o'clock at night where you are at the moment?
Yeah, it's about 9 o'clock, so I just got home from work a few minutes ago and set up to do my favorite show.
Excellent. And John Flowers, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
So today's film is Wolverine. You could either consider it the fourth X-Men film or the first of the X-Men origin films. And we're going to have a crack at trying to pull it apart and see what we liked and didn't like. And as always, we're going to start with a quick chat about what we thought of the film in general and then go to mainly looking at the visual effects work. And I'm going to start, because I expect him to have such an interesting opinion, with the one and only David Strapinis. David?
To say I was not fond of this film would be an understatement.
No, never.
Yeah, it was... It was a mistake from start to beginning, in my opinion. The closest I could kind of think what happened is, if you've ever played the game of Telephone, I think somebody kind of read all of the Wolverine appearances in all the comic books and said it to somebody, and then they said it to somebody, and then they said it to somebody, and then they said it to somebody, and at the end, you know, they finally turned to the screenwriter and said, his hand is made of bananas. And that's kind of the explanation for what they did to what is one of the most beloved characters in all of comic books. Crappy film from start to end, and my only guess is that Hugh Jackman wanted to make a movie that was actually worse in Australia.
Okay, so that would be one banana from Strapinis. Okay. John Flowers.
Well, as much as I hate to agree with David, I want to say
on principle?
That,
go on.
No, I think, you know, the funny thing about Wolverine is it managed to take three things that I just cherish: a screenplay from David Benioff, Wolverine, and visual effects, and it managed to basically just sodomize them into the ground. This film was... I could not agree more with David. This is just a terrible, terrible, terrible
okay,
film.
Okay, so that's one banana, one sodomy.
Wow.
Jason?
Okay. Well, I'm just hastily retyping my review. Look, I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. Serviceable film, pretty much the same vein as all the other films. I've only actually seen the first X-Men. But
you're missing out.
Oh, yeah? Apart from this one. I guess my main thing, I suppose, the main thing for me that keeps it from being Iron Man good is that you just kind of run out of care pretty quick. You know, when everything you know doesn't apply anymore. No one can die. There's no place for physics. Anything is possible. No character's ever at risk. Then, you know, why do you care? Why care about any of the characters, really? So which for me means that it's a little bit empty. Which just leaves, you know, some effects which were pretty good, ranging from awesome to ugh.
Okay, so my opinion is that if you care about Wolverine as, like, I read graphic novels, then you probably didn't like this film. And if you're like me and don't read graphic novels and went along expecting to see, you know, like, basically the grown man in tights kind of funny but entertaining and yet kind of, you know, good action sequence kind of film, then you got exactly what you expected and you thought you got your money's worth, and I liked it. And if somebody said to me, should I go and see Wolverine, I'd say, are you a graphic novel nut? And if they go, yeah, man, I just like, you know, like, no. And if somebody said to me, no, you know, but I just wanted to go out with my girlfriend and see a movie, I'd say, yeah, go see it. It's a great film. Good fun. Everyone likes Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman's great. And so I'm going to take the non-banana, non-sodomized position and say that I thought it was quite fun. And
It helps to not like graphic novels then, or not.
Well,
read
I think
them,
if you're
basically.
If you're serious about your graphic novels and you're really, you know, just... Like, no question this film doesn't get on the radar with, you know, Dark Knight, for example, yeah? But quite frankly, most... So. Action films are worse than this. So it was just like a fun film. I'm sure millions of people around the world will go and see it and
absolutely.
Have a good time.
It's perfect for the target market, I'm sure. 15-year-old boys.
But I presume you disagree, David.
Well, not only does it not get on par with the second or first X-Men, which were both excellent, the second one is truly a great film, I think. It doesn't even meet the level of the rather lackluster third X-Men film. It doesn't even meet the level of, you know, Dumb and Dumberer when Harry met Lloyd. You're taking a character who is dark and brooding and has committed hundreds of thousands of murders over the course of his lifetime and has all that kind of internal struggle, has been through a horrifically painful experience, and turned it into a movie that's safe for, in the audience I saw it with, 6 to 12-year-old boys. I remember reading a Wolverine comic when I was, I believe, 12 or 13. Hang on,
this is my whole point.
You're going to the movie with 12-year-old boys, David, and you're going to the movies with a girlfriend your wife doesn't know about, Mike.
Well, I certainly went with my wife, I can tell you, and she enjoyed it. But my point is, though, getting back to David seriously for a second, right? You're saying that the film doesn't deliver on a character that you describe, but you didn't describe the character in the film. You described the character in the graphic novels. In the film, he hasn't killed hundreds of thousands of people. In the film, he's like quite a nice guy, really.
Oh, excuse me. He did, because the best part of the whole movie was that title sequence where he goes from war to war to war. All they show is that he has spent the past 120 years killing people in the name of his country. Well, actually, not his country, because his country actually doesn't...
He's Canadian.
He's fighting for. He's Canadian. Yeah. I'm not saying anything bad about Canadians, but he's always seems to be fighting on the American side in all those sequences. But you know, he's doing all these, you know, acts of war for 100 years. All he's known is war, and you're telling me that doesn't affect the character psychologically? Of course it does. He's a dark character who has, you know, gigantic bone spikes that are very badly done coming out of the back of his hand, and the idea that that he's still a happy-go-lucky guy who can just live a blue-collar life in the middle of rural Canada is ridiculous. You know, he'd be going through some serious psychological crap, that's never
sleeping.
Really addressed.
Yeah, he had nightmares.
Yeah, he had nightmares. Yeah. But anyway, okay, so look, let's agree that you think it was a travesty against cinematography and filmmaking generally, and let's agree
the middle section fight in New Orleans where they all of a sudden decide to shoot it with a 360-degree shutter, that's travesty against cinematography. The rest of the movie is just a crime against humanity.
Okay, well, notwithstanding the War Crimes Tribunal, let's just go through a few of the facts of the film. It was actually shot on film, shot on... Super 35, with Arafex's and Panavision's Millennium cameras. And it was shot a lot in Australia and New Zealand, doubling for most of those places, except for some of the stuff shot in Canada, I believe. And it was heavily influenced by Hugh Jackman, because he was not only an actor in it, but a producer of it. And he pushed heavily towards the lower PG rating, more accessible to a wider audience than the darker rating that I think one of the earlier directors had wanted to go for. And most importantly, the visual effects were done by a bunch of companies, starting with Hydraulics, who are, you know, very well known in Los Angeles, did Aliens versus Predators and stuff. Then there was also Soho VFX, which is another really good company. Rising Sun Pictures here in Australia, Luma Pictures, I think CineSite did some stuff. Then there was some really good matte painting work done by Matwell Digital and
Hatch.
Yeah. And so it's a roster of companies, and I think we should establish that the budget, well, we don't even really know exactly what the budget is. It certainly wasn't a mega budget. It was deemed to be a moderate budget, because it wasn't that this was, you know, the fourth film in the franchise of the big X-Men per se. So it was a bit of a smaller budget, attempting to be a larger budget kind of film.
150 million or something?
I don't think it was 150 million budget, was it? Oh, I got my wires rocked. Maybe it was. Does anyone know
that? That's what they're saying.
Oh, really? I thought it was a lot less than that.
They're saying 150. Here's the problem with this whole thing, though. The problem with this whole thing is the budget as I understand it, was about $65 to $75 million.
That's what I understood as well. Yeah.
And then what I understand is they pumped $65 to $75 million in basically print and advertising over the last whatever. And, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't at some point talk about the fact that this thing was quote unquote leaked onto the internet at some point, you know.
Well, we will discuss that. But hang on, I don't think it's fair to say the film budget incorporates the marketing and
In general, it's never part of the quoted budget figure.
Yeah, you normally double production. The budget for what they would spend like on a major film. Like you spend $80 million on a film, you could easily spend $60 or $80 million on advertising and marketing with television buys and stuff. But are you?
Well, yeah, I think what's happening now is that they're starting to conflate those two numbers, and they're starting to say when they say production budget, they mean pre-production. Production, post-production, and then distribution.
Well, I mean,
they're actually production... starting to
go on.
Yeah, the pre-production, production, post-production, and to an extent, distribution, but not really. That's all in the quote-unquote budget of the movie. But all the advertising and all that kind of stuff is really just that's not taken into account in any time you see a budget figure. Otherwise you'd see things like the new Julia Roberts movie has a budget of $380 million, which we all know it doesn't cost that much, but once you take into account all the distribution costs, all the
advertising and, yeah,
it does get up there, but it's not, because then how do you take into account the fact that honestly, I don't know who Wolverine has tie-ins with, but, you know, where a commercial's done for, McDonald's. You know, McDonald's is paying for the commercial, but it's tying in with Wolverine because they did some kind of corporate tie-in. That's, you know, $20 million worth of advertising, but the studio didn't pay for it. McDonald's did. So it's when they talk about a budget, it's really just the cost to make the movie and get it in the can.
But what I'm hearing from John is that maybe they've started, or some people have started, combining those numbers just to imply it's a big budget film. Is that what you're saying, John?
I am absolutely saying that. I'm saying that Paramount and Fox have both started doing that. Whenever you see a number from Fox in the last 6 months, when they say production budget, they're including P&A in that.
Okay.
You'd run into big problems with unions and stuff like that when trying to get into the books to get the monies owed to people who own a piece of the movie. You really do run into a problem there. So I don't know how much that's actually going on. They might be saying that.
All I know is my mate who worked on it, and he just worked in second unit. He said there was a bonfire of money every day, enough to pay off his house and 20 other people's on the cruise every single day, just sort of going up in smoke. Wasted, but just...
But hang on, I think any major Hollywood film is, you know, not known for its particularly moderate... Any action, big budget, tentpole picture, I wouldn't... I haven't heard any stories that this was particularly bad in comparison to... You know, I don't think we had sort of... that situation you sometimes get with, you know, the actors doesn't come out of this trailer and the whole crew sits around doing nothing, burning money. They're actually shooting burning money, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Not wasting it, but just, it's definitely...
I mean, the point is that
it's not paperclip and rubber band technology going on.
Can we agree whether the number 60 or 120, it would have been a smaller budget than, say, X-Men 3?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so, and also just in terms of...
And I mean, I gotta say, financially, it was worth it for him. It had a great opening weekend. The plan to go for like a really nonviolent, you know, soft rate. I can't argue with the plan financially, but I think in terms of who the character is, it was the wrong thing. So, you know, well done to them for making a movie that's very commercially successful. I mean, the sequel's already been greenlit, but I think that for the character, it wasn't the right choice.
Okay. Yeah, and I should add just real quickly. I want to add to that, you know, we're talking about a movie that had an opening weekend of $85 million, and as of right now, us recording this, the totals that have come in are $164 million worldwide.
Yeah, which is, you know,
that's a junk.
And
that's
it's only been out here for a week in Australia, and I'm sure it's only just coming out in a few other markets as well.
Let's discuss the leak, because I want to go on the record as saying that I've spoken to the people at Rising Sun Pictures, and Rising Sun Pictures were not involved in the leak of the footage. Rising Sun Pictures had submitted shots, as one does, that had Rising Sun Pictures' name on it, that were in the leaked sort of print of the film that got out on the net. But unfortunately, what's happened is that some really good people, because there are really good people at Rising Sun, have been tainted by this into people thinking that Rising Sun was somehow involved in the leak. And not only is it just my word for it, but there's actually been FBI guys out here in Australia investigating it. So I don't know who did leak it, and let's discuss that. But just to point, go on the record, this rumor that it was a Rising Sun leak just isn't true, and I would really hate to see that company suffer because you know, it just happened to be the only name anyone noticed on the illegal copy. Now, that being said, somebody actually got fired for downloading that illegal copy at Fox, right? One of the employees.
Yeah. An idiot.
Yeah, and I think it's important. One of the things that I think there's a misconception about, so it's interesting to me, the leak actually in a way was a really good thing in general for the visual effects community. Because let me finish, David, before you know... I think it was a good thing because I think it showed the average... I mean, I teach, you know, editing and things like that, and it showed... I had a lot of students come up to me and say that they watched it, and they said that before they saw the leaked version of Wolverine, they didn't really realize how hard or how much work was involved in creating a lot of the effects that they just take for granted in film. And I think that, you know, I think you're getting that kind of sentiment. I think a lot of people around the world are saying, wow, you know, the before and after are pretty interesting. And also, I'd like to point out that Dark Knight was the number one most pirated movie of all time, and it's the second highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah, so you can't necessarily get an argument from me over. I can say point blank that people. I mean, okay, I've got a company that I'm a co-founder of that generates content on the net, and people say you shouldn't care. Some people say you shouldn't care about the fact that you know, it gets pirated because it's all, you know, sort of helps effectively get the word out there. But my point is, there are people out there profiting.
I didn't say that, though.
No, I know you're not saying that, but I'm saying there are people out there that that distribute sort of stuff that they have nicked, and they try and sell advertising on their sites to do it, and they even put copyright symbols at the bottom of their site. And I'm like, you know what, dude, you didn't friggin' work on it, so you don't get to make money on it. Well, yeah, of course, we're our stuff, but we're actually not that. We're not that pirated. Actually, we have a really, really good community that tends to be incredibly respectful, and we appreciate them tremendously. And we could put in more things to stop them pirating that we don't, because, as I say, we have a really good relationship with the people that are members. But my point is this, right? If you didn't work on the film, I don't care how much you'd like to watch it for free, you don't get to, you know, like, you should contribute to the process. You should either contribute to the process, pay for the right to do it, or at least in some way, you know, allow the system to continue. And so I'm way against, and I really think that while your point is valid, that it's really interesting to see that, had they put that out on a DVD, like some of the great Laserdiscs had, you know, very detailed making ofs, then we'd get the same benefit. I think I'm speaking for David here when I say that we'd say that it came at a very great cost to the community. The benefits of letting editors see how much work there is in VFX came at a really high price. But what do you think, David? We cut you off before.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I will say that when the leak happened, the amount of security that goes on around Hollywood sets went up by a factor of tenfold. I'll also say that anyone listening to this who wants to work in the movie industry, the games industry, the television industry, who downloaded the pirate copy, who didn't go and pay for an actual ticket, regardless of whether or not you went and saw the movie afterwards, I hope you never, ever earn money from your trade. And third, I would say that the film that got released in the theaters, or most likely will get released on DVD as the unrated or director's cut, is the version that the director wanted you to see as he wanted to see it. Not the version that was in progress, that was unfinished. While I agree that seeing movies in progress is educational to those that want to make them, it's not some punk kid who got a hold of his dad's DVD copy or what have you to release it on the net if the director and the studio and the creative people involved do not want it seen. It is, regardless, and I can't believe I'm actually going to use this phrase in relation to this movie, filmmaking is an art, and the art that is shown in the theaters is the version that you should be seeing, not the version that is released early. And Personally, I think this was released by somebody who still had their knickers bunched up over the whole Watchmen thing and wanted to get back at Fox in some way, shape, or manner. That all being said, I hope that anyone who pirates a movie gets hit by a large meteorite from space and dies.
Okay, well, I'm not quite there with you on that, but well, I love the expressiveness. John, do you want to comment?
Oh no, I'm sorry. I was going to add. I had 2 points, and I didn't want to. I wanted to make sure that the second one didn't get lost, which was, you know, as much as I am sometimes against the sort of big Hollywood machine. I mean, certainly I am a capitalist like the rest of us, and I do enjoy creating something and getting paid for that creation. But there is a little bit of a disconnect here, because all of the stories that I've seen have done something which I don't think is very nice, which is they've blamed visual effects houses for the leak. Now, you mentioned Rising Sun before, so one of the things I'd like to do is I'd like to just sort of publicly state that I don't think it's actually possible for a single visual effects house to leak the entire film. My experience in working on films is that as a VFX house, you don't really have access to the entire film. Not in the way that it would have been leaked onto the internet. I mean, I really feel like the leak is being blamed on houses who wouldn't necessarily have had access to the entire film. And I think that's a real tragedy, and I don't like to see that happen.
Yeah. Do you have a comment, Jace?
Well, I guess it'd be... I mean, I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. I mean, yeah, I'm sure that not everybody gets to see all of the film. David, you would know, of course. It's very hard to see the whole film, even if you're embedded in the middle of it. But I'm sure... I'm surprised it really doesn't happen more often. There's got to be lots of, in lab people, sound mixers, anybody who will work on the whole thing from go to woe, and not just on an effects shot, are definitely going to have their hands on something on the full length. So, you know, there must be millions of opportunities.
Yeah, there's millions of opportunities, but there are millions of people that work in this industry that are honest, hardworking, care about film professionals that just wouldn't do it because it's unethical.
Yeah, it's clearly some sort of, you know, cleaner at the lab or someone who's gone, oh, what's this in the skip, you know, and ran off with it. I don't think it's anyone really who's emotionally or financially connected with the film.
Yeah, well, my guess as to probably what happened, and I'm not going to say literally it was this guy, but it was somebody who would have access to the whole film, such as a guy editing the trailer, one of the producers, or what have you, that could have a copy of the movie on DVD and brought it home for a perfectly valid reason, and their son or daughter or brother or someone who had access to it showed it to a friend of theirs, while they're over. And, you know, honestly, this does happen all the time. I've seen movies early this way. By people who were involved in the movie, like, hey, do you want to see the movie I'm working on? And will show me a rough edit or what have you. And, you know, copying a DVD is not really a mystery technology at this point. Somebody went out of the room for a few minutes, and boom, you have a copy of the disc. You know, by someone who is not really your friend. So I don't think it was actually anyone involved in the movie itself, because who would want to hurt, you know, the work that they've been pouring, you know, regardless of whether you're making, you know, Doubt or Wolverine or, you know, Beach Blanket Bingo, for your
lesbian vampires too. Yes.
Yeah. You know, you're spending a lot of your time and energy and, you're pouring it into something that's, you know, for 6, 8, 10, 12 months or even longer in some people's cases. And you don't, and you don't want to see that spoiled. You want people to see it as you've intended it. So
as a director, I'd be totally gutted if that got out. I mean, everyone knows who's seen Rushes, and if you have seen this, I haven't seen it. This download, I haven't, but I can only imagine. Rush's does not look good. Nothing mixed with no sound, no sound effect. Every single thing that makes of takes a film from crappy Rush's cut together to the finished thing, it just adds so much, and it just really kind of gives everybody a bit of a glimpse into how kind of crappy a very, very rough cut can be.
Yeah.
I would be absolutely emotionally gutted if it was me. Just like, apart from anything, you'd just be embarrassed, like, oh, everyone really saw how bad it really was to begin with.
Or the other thing I was thinking about when this happened is, you know, on every movie, you have the takes where people are hamming it up or doing whatever because they're playing around or whatever. And sometimes the editors will throw that in as a joke or I've literally seen edits of movies where they've chosen the worst take of everything just to make like a really bad version of the movie. And if that got out, that could be devastating to a movie. Or
You could have a placeholder in a shot where you go, we just need something here, and you whack something in, and it's going to be fixed, replaced, or reshot later.
Yeah, because you're waiting for the reshoots. Or what would happen if, let's say, you have a scene where you have an actress who is topless, but you don't actually see anything in the movie because, you know, she doesn't want that to be seen. And, you know, in the edit that they have, you see, you know, her naughty bits.
Yeah,
and
it's full gate, or it's not racked, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other implications that could happen by having loose security around this kind of stuff. And I think this is actually the second incident, which was the first one I can think of in recent memory, was on Spider-Man 3, where the trailer got leaked early. But you're going to see it more and more, and I think that's
horrible.
Well,
the Hulk is a good one, too.
I'm going to swing the conversation back to the film itself because I don't want to become, you know, this week in some program. And I'm going to swing back and pick
this
it
week
up.
In piracy.
This week in piracy. I'm going to ask you guys
very popular
about
podcast in Somalia.
I'm going to ask you guys about the action sequences. Has anyone seen this company 8711? Jace?
No, I'd love to, but I'm amazed that a company like this exists. I mean, I've heard of fight coordinators, but these guys actually are,
an
if
action
I get it right,
they
are action
company.
Designers.
Yeah, they have a big converted warehouse, and these guys do a couple of things. Firstly, they do, and I don't know whether this was the case with Hugh Jackman, but they actually do actor or star training to get people basically bulked up and in shape for doing action sequences. These guys are ex-Navy SEALs. And then they also do second unit directing, martial arts choreography, wire work, all that kind of stuff, stunt work. And so apparently, because I don't know how they kept under my radar, but something like the Bourne trilogy films or Watchmen or 300, these guys go in and sort of work out the choreography for the kind of martial arts / action sequences and can actually second unit direct them. And I guess if someone's out there and you guys know 8711, I'd love to interview them or talk to them. I think that sounds like a phenomenally interesting company.
Anything where you're packaging something up like that as a production, if you can sort of totally offload that entire thing and someone can take care of the training, getting the guys in shape, the rehearsing, blocking the whole action out and, you know, giving it to you, then that's production's just going to leap on that kind of stuff. If it's everything, something, a whole chunk of something they can offload as a package, that's brilliant. More power to them.
I mean, I'm really interested in the whole second unit directing side of films because I think there's the Bond films in particular kind of pioneered this. They have this complete sort of car unit, and then they have So the chase unit kind of just does the chases, but almost on every Bond film when they were in their stride, they would have the same kind of director and crew go and do the chase sequences and they do the fight sequences. And it was almost like there was principal photography that was covering a small part of what was going on. And then there was another unit that was covering, you know, all the various individual bits of it. And it was just, have you guys come across these kind of specialist units much in your work, David?
Yeah. It's kind of funny because when you go and work on, you know, big action movies or what have you, you're expecting to see all the fun stuff. And if you're working with the principal unit, with the, you know, the principal actors and the main director, you know, all he cares about is the emotion of it and working with the actors on the quiet stuff. And then you'll hear like, oh, what did second unit today do today? Like, oh yeah, they did the whole shooting scene and they flipped a car off a bridge. And you're like, what? How did I miss that? And like, I just watch people talk to each other all day. And yes, I think this is all because you got to do second unit on Red Dwarf and you've tasted
exactly.
it.
All of a sudden.
It's like heroin.
I'm here to promote second unit directors as being the new black. I think that's very cool.
Love second unit.
Have you done second unit, or you just have
yeah,
to
that's
second unit?
Yeah, pretty much all I ever did. You know, if anything that wasn't involving TVCs, if it was series or features, I was always for some reason, you know, second unit. I was always great. I mean, in a way, well, they always sort of said it was twice the focal length and half the time. You always had the tricky shots and the half the time to do it, but it was always the fun stuff.
But less supervision, though, in a sense. Like, you're away from the focus.
Even as a camera assistant, I almost got to direct shots. You know, it was kind of wild. And it was, you know, it's when you look at something like Wolverine, and as you say with the Bond stuff, probably, particularly if it's an action-based film, you're talking about almost the second unit director is almost more, it ends up being more important than the main unit. And so I know that sounds terrible to say, but in a way, if you've got great actors, that dialogue stuff is, you know, well, it's almost going to shoot itself if you've got a great DP, to be honest.
Well, let's discuss the action sequence with the helicopter where he's taking off on the motorbike and he's got attack helicopters coming after him with, I believe, Zero snipering him. And he manages to take down a chopper. So from a visual effects point, John, what do you think?
Well, this is an interesting film because it is absolutely clear to me. I stuck around through the end credits, you know, through the first thing and then the very, very last thing.
I missed the last thing. I only just heard about the last thing.
The last thing.
But it's interesting because I definitely saw how many effects houses were involved in this. And I think that was absolutely crystal clear while you're watching it. There are some shots that are just great. There's some matte paintings that are just breathtaking. You know, there's a lot to love. And then there's some things that are just, they're so campy and ridiculous that I can't believe they made it onto film.
Yes.
And it seems like every sequence has a mixture of those, you know, including the sequence that you're talking about. I mean, there's a wide shot where he's on the motorcycle where the color replacement on the background is so bad that the freaking grass is blue. It's
all of that green screen stuff of Hugh on the bike was really bad. All of that, I think, was and yet, as
awful.
You say, you're cutting it together with all the live action and the practical explosions on set and the chopper crashing was all fabulous. And then you just get taken out of the film every second shot by a shot of Hugh green screened against a badly comped in background that's either too out of focus or, as you say, the wrong color. It's kind of, or the matte lines were almost look like they were glowing. I'm not sure. How does that happen, guys? I don't understand. I saw it through a lot of that sequence that the matte lines quite soft around the person, but also they seem to have a bit of a glow in there just to make it even worse.
I mean, it shouldn't happen, but sometimes what happens is that you get for example, a very bright green screen that's got a very dark background. And when you start keying it, you're either eating in tremendously to the image or you end up with halation. I mean, it shouldn't happen, but you know, you should fix it, basically.
So is this an emulsion thing?
It's just in the picture, but it's
optical.
Light wraps around things. So if you have a bright light behind someone.
A bright green screen, really.
I mean, it could be that you're rotoing somebody and it's the dirt behind them and the light is kicking up so that it's virtually white and they're on a black bike. And then somebody wants to put in a black helicopter behind and it's like, well, all his edges is naturally light wrapping to a white color, which is the dirt behind him. And yet you're putting a dark object in, which would cause none of that light wrap, and so it just becomes a pain.
It was pretty consistent, unfortunately. It was pretty consistent with everything. You could, all of the stuff with Hugh, you know, breaking himself with his blades to do the sort of U-turn on the bike, and all that stuff was so clearly green screen. And then you'd cut to second unit car point of view shot, which was obviously all in camera. So it sort of definitely sort of popped in and out, and you could definitely tell all the stuff they shot green screen with Hugh, unfortunately. The other part of it being that backgrounds, for me, was, rather than just criticising, come up with why I thought it didn't quite work, was that the backgrounds, the depth of field in the backgrounds, there seems to be a propensity to make the backgrounds too soft. If you've got a background plate, it seems to be like people maybe aren't quite thinking entirely optically, and it backgrounds always seem to be that little bit too out of focus, which then thus makes it look, that makes it look less light, makes it look underlit, which makes it look like it wasn't shot outside.
And the other problem is that, like in the car shots, as my ultimate yardstick of any effects film, I found that the balance of the interior lighting to the exterior lighting was too perfect, and that you didn't blow out the windows, and so again, it didn't look great there for me.
Yeah, a lot of the background plates looked like they were shot to be very pretty, but not necessarily to be very pretty background plates that would work for the final shot.
Let's swing our attention to what worked really well.
Can I just say with that sequence though that. I thought it all, firstly, two things. I thought, first of all, as a sequence, it all worked really well. It really flowed. It didn't feel too cutty, like sort of Quantum of Solace shittiness. It just kind of felt, you know, all had a really quite good flow, all cut really well. And awesome on-set stuff that, you know, the helicopter explosion, the physical explosion of it all sort of shattering in bits and pieces, and that was all great. But, yeah, as I say, there's a few shots in there that let it down. But, yeah, as a whole, it all cut together well as a sequence, don't you mean?
Actually, the only thing that bugs me, and it always bugs me, is, and it bugs me since the Bionic Man, where, you know, he's got a bionic arm and he'd lift up a car, and I'd be like, he hasn't got a bionic back. How come he doesn't break his back? And in this, it was like he's got, you know, Wolverine has obviously the blades, but I'm thinking the amount of inertia of a helicopter blade hitting your hand.
Why aren't his kidneys inside the helicopter?
Well, okay, again, this is the comic book nerd in me coming out, like, the way
please, can we start with that?
Well, no. Sorry. The idea behind it, Wolverine the character.
And when did Adam Ant get a metal named after him?
Yeah, what the hell?
That Adam Ant's, you know, that's supposed to be the hardest metal known to man. That is completely and utterly indestructible, impenetrable, and that his claws are supposed to be to a, you know, the equivalent of the world's sharpest samurai sword. And I don't know if you've ever seen that slow mo shot of a bullet being shot at a samurai sword, but the bullet just kind of cleaves in half without the sword blade even moving a millimeter or even shaking. And I think, you know, the plausibility factor, you know, when you're dealing with a guy who's 150 years old and can heal any wound, you have to at least separate yourself from reality a little bit.
Okay, well, while I'm being a smartass,
sure,
how come
no
he
problem.
Got to that age at, like, the beginning of the Battle of Independence or the War of Independence, whatever you call it in America, and stayed that age through the First World War, Second World War, Vietnam War? Like, did he get to a point and then stop aging? Or, I mean,
slowed.
Why didn't he just, like,
slowed,
get,
isn't it?
Why wasn't he an adolescent after 70 years and an adult after 100? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think if you had the idea of somebody being in puberty for 70 years, they would have found some way of killing themselves.
Well, you know what I mean? Like, it's like you get up to an adult, and then suddenly you just, as a young adult, it's like, you know, Hugh Jackman age, you just stay at that age for the next 100 years. Anyway, so let me just be less of a wanker about this and jump to some really, really good stuff. And I think some really, really good stuff, and I hope you'll agree with me, is the smash nuclear power plant.
Absolutely.
The end sequence, I think you'd call it the aftermath of the attack on top of the nuclear power plant, so that you've got a smashed kind of post-apocalyptic sections of twisted concrete. Did anyone not think that was just gorgeous?
I thought it was very nice. I thought that whole sequence was really, really fantastic, and especially when you take into account how quickly they did it. I thought the look of it was slightly different than the look of the rest of the film, and that was a little bit jarring.
I mean, this is Luma Pictures, and presumably matte painting work done by some of the, I think, Mattwell Digital contributed to that. I'm wrong in saying that. Maybe it was all Luma. But, I thought it was really, really cool. Like, I thought that was all filmed on Cockatoo Island here in Sydney. And just 2 weeks ago, I went camping on that island with my kids. And I can tell you, it doesn't have a nuclear power plant destroyed or undestroyed on it.
There's a lot of green screen in there as well.
Yeah.
And obviously all of the fighting on top of the, obviously on all the top fighting on top of the cooling tower is all green.
Oh, Mortal Kombat?
Yeah, the Mortal Kombat sequence.
Who said at the beginning of the show that the trouble with that is that you, by this stage, are pretty much convinced that nothing will hurt them, so you're not even worried about them.
It's like the fourth or fifth battle. If this one doesn't work out, they'll just meet again in another amazingly spooky location.
But wow, I mean, they just might said that, fall. We know he doesn't die because he appeared in the next three films that are... And this is the trouble with the prequel, isn't it? You know what happens to the characters.
Yeah, what
but,
if... you weren't exactly scared if he was going to fall off the cooling tower or anything, really, you know.
No.
He might get cut.
Ouch. Which would only repair itself.
The only thing that was also really upsetting about that whole sequence is when they said it was Three Mile Island, I was like, oh, right, this is supposed to be the 70s because there's absolutely no clue as to... what era it was supposed to be in, not via hairstyles, not via music, not via, you know, there's a modern Hummer, there's a modern helicopter, there's modern, very, very modern guns. You know, and it was, you know, and then it's supposed to be Three Mile Island. I was like, I don't think so. But the end sequence, the matte paintings and the digital sets were... so beautifully done that they didn't fit in with the rest of the movie because, you know, the framing was well done and the lighting was well done and it just didn't blend with the rest of the movie.
Could you say it was like a separate, it was like the third act, or it was, you know, you're moving into a whole different act and a whole different part of the movie, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah, I agree creatively, yeah. But can I, one of the shots which stood out, and as soon as I saw it again today on your... on your article, on FX Guide article today, Mike, absolutely gorgeous, and it stood out as I was watching the film, the beautiful sort of aftermath of the crashed cooling tower, this beautiful kind of arc of debris as he's carrying dead Hypno Chick across the wasteland. Just there's a couple of just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful shots there. I'm just in awe of someone who can just physically create this out of just nothing and, you know, stills grabs and textures. And I think that's beautiful. It looks like a real storyboard, you know. They took it straight out of the storyboard frame.
But, yes, I think it was really, really good. Now, the thing that, for the other side of the sort of coin, if we were to talk about it, I think that stuff was magnificent. The shot that, for me, didn't work so well was the tracking on the claws in the bathroom, cutting the sink scene. Anyone else?
The very first time we see his claws in the farmhouse?
Yeah, yeah. When he's in the bathroom and he sort of accidentally cuts the sink in half.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, I think Superman's parents would have been more upset when they cut his sink in half. But the claws in that sequence, why didn't they just use practical props strapped to his hands? Because those were... really horrible looking claws in that sequence.
It wasn't good, was it?
I didn't think it was good.
It wasn't so much the tracking to me. It was just the fact they didn't have any texture. They just looked like they were painted, like they were liquid. It didn't have any sort of grain to it or any reflections. It felt like sort of test renders where you're not really putting any textures to it or something. I mean, I'm speaking out my ass, but also it also felt like they looked like they were all rendered at a completely different shutter speed to the rest of the stuff. They were quite a sharp. There was not so much motion blur, and it just helped them not fit in so much. It was because it was quite a pivotal scene. The first time he sort of really sort of sees the new blades, and the first time he really sort of examines them. The first time we really see them quite close on the film, and it was a scene that needed a little bit more love, I think.
In the other earlier Wolverine films, I mean the other X-Men films, they just seem to look better in those. Isn't that
interesting that the claws actually looked better in the earlier X-Men films?
I'm not alone in that, right?
No, I think you're exactly right. And we could also get into Professor X and how he was de-aged at the end.
What did you think of that?
Fucking step backwards from the X-Men movie. Wow.
What was that? Sorry, you're talking about the end
definitely not Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
Where Xavier's so there in front brutal. Of his bad 3D helicopter. Is that what you were talking about? Yeah.
So I have a question. So my perspective on the claws was that they were... it was claws fail from start to finish. Every single time I saw them, I winced, I cringed, I shifted in my seat. It was the worst... is the worst thing I've ever seen. The worst track I've seen B movies with better tracking, and so my question is, this thing had to have been rushed. I mean, just like pushed through a garden hose, rushed like nothing has ever been rushed. The work is so bad on the claws. And I'm so sorry that it is, because it could have been so much better.
Well, I think some of the claw shots
were more than okay.
They some of them purely worked, but that bathroom scene, my guess is that
I would like to hear one claw scene that worked. I mean, starting with the bone claws
on young Logan.
Yeah, the bone claws looked okay. Wow. They were good.
I must have been sitting too close to the screen or something.
I thought it was all right. And there were some scenes where
they were literally shifting at the knuckle on every scene that I saw.
Look, I agree the bathroom scene was bad. I'm just saying
that was a bad one because it really was. You're right in close on them, and he's really examining them. So obviously we are as well. So yeah, it didn't quite have the love that scene should have had.
I quite liked the him being infused underwater with the. The robotic kind of needles of
That was all pretty impressive. I
had adamantium.
Do you know what was CGI and what wasn't there? I guess everything in contact with his body was actually probably replaced.
Yeah, the exterior line of mechanisms were there for real, and he was obviously there. But yeah, basically all the mechanisms that were then going at him and stuff. But I mean, in a film,
anything moving was a VFX shot. Yeah,
yeah, that was pretty impressive. Underwater and with particles in the water as well, and he's wriggling away. I thought I had
that classic kind of I don't want to watch as the needle goes in kind of thing, where it wasn't looking like as if. I don't know. I totally buy him hearing it underwater, but I'm whatever. But that was exactly what you want out of a. Scene like that, right? Like he's our hero's in danger. It looks like he's dead. He's not dead, but there is some like something happening to him in the tank that no mere mortal would be able to survive the pain. Kind of, So I thought that all worked really well, and it was a nice kind of sci-fi kind of set with all the evil military guys around it. It was exactly what I expected, but I thought it was well done. And yet, as you say, some of the other stuff. For whatever reason, just seemed, and I agree with you, Jason. I don't think you're speaking out your ass when you say that. I think it was just felt like, okay, that looks good. Now what we need to do is work on the textures for the final, rather than the final.
Oh, which we're shipping today. Oh, but I haven't done the tech slamming door.
Now I think the problem is that I'm saying it deliberately wrong, but I know. But these adamant claws, they're meant to not have any scratches because they're meant to be harder than anything that would scratch them, right? And so I think somebody said, well, they shouldn't have any scratches and they shouldn't have any marks and they shouldn't have any defects and they should just be perfect. And the trouble is that perfect looks like CG, and so they don't look real.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the samurai sword is going to have imperfections no matter how how friggin' strong it is. So
these things were grafted onto this weird bone structure, so there's a whole question mark around that too.
Yeah, I was wondering if they're going to come out shiny and bone, or like shiny bone, and then there's going to be a whole sharpening scene coming up, which I thought would have been good, but
we may all be analyzing it more than anyone actually involved in the film has ever done.
Well, see, and here's the thing, right? David Benioff wrote the original screenplay, and so this is not me coming at this from a comic book perspective, right? This is me coming at this from David Benioff can write perspective, right? He wrote 25th Hour. He wrote Troy. The guy knows what he's doing, and you just have to believe that something went terribly, terribly wrong in the screenplay with him, and so all of these things that where you're. Right now we're going, well, okay, how do, adamant bullets pierce adamant skulls? They're both indestructible. What's going on? I'm totally confused. Or, why do bones turn into sharp samurai blades? Or, how do you stick a needle in someone and then somehow it goes into their bone structure? None of these things make any sense, right?
Yeah, but that's what I'm trying to get at, though, is that there's a visual effects discussion about, in my opinion, as to why I think those claws don't look right, like they don't track, or I think that they should have had micro imperfections and micro bevels to sell them. Now, some of the points you're raising are a creative point, to which there's a producer sitting somewhere who's probably not listening to this, but if he was, he'd say, well, yeah, kid, but I made like $180 million on the first opening weekend, so, who do you think's right?
Who cares?
Yeah,
right.
And well, so, I think The biggest thing, I think, was that they didn't put reflections into the claws.
Right.
Because doing complex reflections of, claw to claw, claw to environment, claw to actor, changing light, all that kind of stuff would have been a lot more complicated. And they just kind of took a more stylized, there was an artist in Japan in the 70s and 80s, Suriyama, who would paint like sexy robot girls, you know, major airbrush artist.
Yep.
And I think they kind of took that approach with the claws, where, okay, it's reflecting blue on the top and brown on the bottom, and there's a black line down the middle. Look, it's chrome. And rather than, you know, all the complex reflections that would be going on if it was really in that environment, you know, as metal, as perfect metal.
Yeah, I think that the worst part about this is what John said earlier, which was that, you know, if we hadn't seen this in the previous films, then we'd have all been like, well, you know, yeah, blah, blah. But as they kind of had already solved it, it's kind of like, well, why do we have to go backwards? And I also think there was a consistency issue for me as well, in that sometimes these things were so long that they seemed to be longer than his forearm, and sometimes they were thicker than his fingers. And it, I just didn't feel like they had the kind of, like, making those claws, knives, what do you want to call them? What are they called if you know what you're talking about? Which obviously
claws.
I don't. Claws, thank you. If those claws are exceptionally long, to the point of being kind of swords rather than daggers, I think they start to look a bit silly. Like they just, you know, it felt like they were shorter and more vicious in the first three X-Men films. And maybe I'm wrong there, but does anyone else think they were like they've got longer as he's gone along? Or no? Is that just me?
No, I didn't notice. But it was, as you say, it was a good opportunity to actually take them a bit step further. You know, if they can evolve Yoda, you know, you could, even these simple things, you could evolve the claws somewhat.
So, okay, so leaving the claws aside, because I think we've all agreed that we don't like them. Do we have any opinions on the other characters away from Wolverine that were obviously, you know, existing with Wolverine in this film? So his brother, the guy from the Black Eyed Peas, any of those other characters?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because you have basically Liev Schreiber, who is, I think, just
Liev. Trust me, he gets it's.
Don't
Liev.
Say Liev. Liev.
All okay. Right, you have Liev, noted. Who spells his name exactly the same way that someone who might accidentally be called Liev spells his name. He is a very good actor, I think.
Yeah.
And I got to say, the whole time I was watching this, all I could think about is I love Hugh Jackman. He's great. He was great in the first two X-Men. You know, he's been good in other stuff, not Van Helsing, but other stuff. I thought Liev carried this film pretty strongly for at least the first half of it. I mean, his character completely disintegrated toward the end, but I loved the way, and I don't know if some of this was digital, but some of it was practical. The claws on, he's basically Sabretooth in the future, by the way. So you probably figured that out, but the claws were obviously digital in a lot of places and practical in others, but I thought those claws actually made a lot of sense. You know,
that's exactly where I was going with that.
Aggressive.
I thought, yeah, it's like get the guy that did the claws on him to do Wolverine because they worked.
He was busy.
Well, I thought they were great. I mean, yeah, I totally agree with you, John. I thought they were really good.
Gambit was freaking spectacular. The Gambit's the guy that does the card tricks.
Yeah, yeah, Gambit was
that was pretty amazing.
Man, the card stuff was great to me.
I would disagree
David.
There. Well,
there's a surprise, David. You're disagreeing with me.
No. I mean, I thought as a full caveat, the guy who plays Gambit, Taylor Kitsch, I actually have known him for years before he even got on Friday Night Lights. One of my best friends in the world used to be his roommate, actually.
I know a guy who knows a guy who knows him too, David.
Let's get back to Gambit.
I thought the energy card part, like with the little purple lightning, that was actually the best digital lightning I've seen. It was the closest to the old hand drawn lightning that I love so much. And the eye effect was pretty damn cool. But the actual cards, when he's shuffling them, and I thought they didn't feel like they had any weight to them or anything like that. They were physically accurate because, you know, he's just supposed to be doing card tricks. He's not supposed to be using any kind of superpower on the cars. It's just, you know, he's a sleight of hand kind of guy. So right. they felt.
But that goes
a
back
bit...
to the comic book. I mean, that's another comic book issue, right?
Because I didn't have any of that backstory. It just, to me, it looked like he was superhuman special.
I've got to tell you, I would have liked to have seen the breakout that got him free. That was a whole interesting thing that I was thinking sitting there when I heard about it. I was like, oh, how did this guy get out? I hope we find out how that happened, because he seemed like an interesting character.
Well, I mean, if you want to get into story problems, how about the fact that the guy who escaped from the government facility, that it took the other criminals approximately 30 seconds to find out where he is and show up? Why didn't they come and get him at any other point?
Can we talk about Kestrel?
Can we please talk about the fight sequence that takes place there in the alley with the horrible straight out of the 70s speed up on cutting down the
the fire
ladder?
Escape?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was so awesome.
Now I did ask my friend about that, who was involved in this sequence, and he said there was nothing ever shot digitally, nothing ever acquired anything. What one of the issues was, they did shoot a lot of stuff that was at shorter shutter speeds, like shoot it quite sharply. But the studio balked on that, and they sort of started to double back on a bit of that footage. But I think possibly this was footage that was shot with a really sharp shutter speed, and they actually went too far by adding motion blur. I'm not sure, because there was certainly nothing. I did ask, because those shots stood out to me too. Looked like they'd been shot digitally with a more than 180 degree
shutter.
That was
my second reference to $6 Million Man, by the way.
I missed that one.
That just screamed, like, all of a sudden it literally went, you know, looking like film to looking like a soap opera for a good like minute and a half. And I just thought it was like possibly pickup shots or a reshoot or something that was shot on a digital camera versus on film. Yeah.
Could always possibly be. It did look quite odd.
There were so many things I was trying to catalog them. I think they crossed the line. There was like about 15 things going wrong in that sequence.
Well, that was also I think the problem with the cards guy, because I thought his stuff was really really great. It did get a little bit lost in that sequence, because then the bit before that there was so much going on that the excellent work I thought on Card Dude was a little bit lost.
Yeah,
there.
Gambit. But, maybe Hugh Jackman. I am pronouncing that correctly, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he.
Or Sir, as he's called here.
He likes to pronounce
Sir Jackman. Yeah, exactly. Maybe he was like, you know, this Gambit character is turning out to be kind of a scene
too
whore.
Cool
stealing. Yeah, he's stealing the show. let's do something to make people hate this scene and, you know, move it so that they don't remember how awesome he was. I don't think so.
You're a hard
man. He's a very, very nice guy.
Hugh Jackman, yeah, let's face it, in this country is revered for being about the nicest guy. And if anyone wanted to point to a typical Australian, we would all want everyone in the world to point to Hugh Jackman. So, yeah, you can't.
Oh, he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, he's a true pro. I mean, yes, who knows what happens in the edit room. But, yeah, apparently awesome guy, great on set, really patient.
We have no belief that he in any way sabotaged anyone else's scene. That was a joke.
Who knows?
Yeah, I was kidding.
This is just a quick little story about how awesome a person Hugh Jackman is. Last year at Comic-Con, he was on a panel, and someone pointed out the fact that the man who invented Wolverine was in the audience in the front row. Hugh Jackman went down and shook his hand and said, "Thank you for giving me a career."
Yeah.
So, I mean, he is a enormously nice and well-respected guy, and I'm not going to say anything bad about him personally, but I just think that some of the choices in this film were not the best.
Well, I think it comes down to two things, just to summarize, right? The two things are, if you really wanted a serious X-Men film, the producers, for whatever reason, and you can't really blame them, wanted a wider audience and went for a less threatening, less dark solution, which necessitated a certain bunch of story points and things, which all led to, if you're familiar with the characters and love them to death, you probably don't going to like the film so much. The second problem we've got, which is I think more what this show should be about, is there were parts of the visual effects that were just patchy, right? Where there were parts of the visual effects that were magnificent, and it's a shame that it wasn't more consistent. And unfortunately, when you put both of those things together, it's hard for a more critical-eyed, hardcore graphic novel type fan to get into this film. Having said that, if you're a parent and you want to take your, you know, 12-year-old kid because they just think it's cool as, then you probably thank the Lord that it's not more graphic. Thank the Lord that it is only PG rated, and thank the Lord that it isn't as frightening because it's not quite as realistic. Any which way around it, we're going to get another bite of this cherry, right? Because as I think you said, John, they've already approved the sequel, so we'll get to review it again sometime down the track. Hey,
one last comment on the visual effects, which I think, you know, coming off of what you just said, Mike, is, you know, on these films where you have a bunch of smaller boutiques who are doing, you know, a handful of shots rather than awarding it to one major house or two major houses or what have you, is... you know, the consistency of the work has to be there across all the houses, because if you have eight vendors who are working on a movie and seven of them do, you know, nomination quality work, and one does a phone it in type job, you're going to come away with a kind of bad view of all the visual effects. And thinking that there's one or two good shots rather than, well, a bunch, you know, most of it was good, but I'm only remembering the bad. That, you know, that it for any, you know, work, whether it's the score, whether it's the visual effects, you tend to remember the bad more than the good. So there was some really fine visual effects work in this movie. But unfortunately, the shots that are bad kind of stick out a little bit too badly to overlook,
but not too badly for it to gross 160 million in the opening weekend. So hey, look, I'm going to wind up there because we're running out of time, but I do want to thank everybody for being on the show, and let's do a quick group around before we talk about next week's what's coming up. Let's quick group around where people can connect with you guys. And David, you're still busily working on the film, presumably not getting out much and doing any stand-up or anything?
No, but you can find me on the Twitter as David Strapenis, all one word. I will, if you have a question or whatever, you can feel free to ask, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. And I'll actually be wrapping up sometime in the foreseeable future. The end is in sight, and then I'll be taking some time off.
And then we'll get to do a VFX show about a certain film in stereo, and that would be a fun discussion. Hey, John, before we get to how people can find you, I see that you've got some more podcasts out, in particular another one of your Avid podcasts out that downloaded this morning. Is that right? Am I thinking that, aren't I?
Yeah, a new That Post show. There is a new That Post show out. It's a discussion about Avid 3.5, 30 days later. The big deal about this particular discussion is we are, as far as I know, the first podcast to ever actually have two of the guys who helped actually create Avid 3.5 on the show. So
that's
what
I was going to actually mention. That it was when you started introducing the guys, I was like, oh, quite a lot of people on this podcast. And then you started introducing who they were, and I was just some really talented people contributing to that show. So well done on that.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, great guests. If you can stomach having seven guests on one show, I think you'll love it.
And where can people follow you if they want to find out more about what you're up to?
Probably lifezero.org. That's my blog, sometimes updated. Or I'm lifezero on Twitter also.
And Jace, what about you, sir? You are not shooting at the moment, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the pleasure of your company. But
absolutely.
What are you up to at the moment?
I am between projects. And quoting and treatmenting.
And,
the endless stream of typing treatments. Well, so you can find all of that mundanity on twitter.com/Wingrove or at jasonwingrove.com, and also via Red Center podcast with your good self at fxguide.com/Red Center. Center spelt the stupid way.
The Australian way. Actually, I hate to do a plug for ourselves, but there's actually a pretty decent interview in the latest Red Center podcast with the Academy Award winning cinematographer Anthony Dodd Mantle, who discusses what it was like to shoot with the SI2Ks on Slumdog. And if you were into
awesome
filmmaking
interview.
Sorry to be self-serving, but it was actually, I think, a pretty interesting interview, and a lot of people have commented on it. And you can find me, of course,
damn awesome.
You can find me, of course, over at FX Guide, where we have a story on Wolverine with a bunch of behind-the-scenes shots and stuff. And, of course, I'm on Twitter at Mike Seymour. John, Do you want to give thanks to our hardworking team behind the scenes?
Sure. We'd like to thank our tireless producers. Kristen Martin does a ton of work behind the scenes, up to and including edit this bad boy. Lori Apthorpe and Kevin Hansen also do dossiers, as they were. And this is a joint PixelCore and FX Guide Productions.
And coming up next week on the show, we're going to be tackling Star Trek. I don't know. Is it got an official title other than Star Trek? Is it just Star Trek, the new one?
No, it's Star Trek.
Okay, because it's a film worth discussing. How about that? I'm not going to give anything away other than to say I think it'll be a lively and interesting discussion and a bunch of really interesting behind-the-scenes stuff, because we've been talking to a bunch of people, including the filmmakers, about that. So we'll have lots of insights and stuff. That's coming up next week on the show. Thank you so much for everyone that's been responding and doing stuff. We've also got some good retro stuff. The way that we like to work the show is to include both new stuff and some retro stuff. We have some really cool retro stuff also coming up. So we like to cover the new films, and over coming weeks we will be covering a bunch of new films from Angels and Demons and Terminator and stuff. But we're also going to go back and do things like Brazil and Jurassic Park and I think even Back to the Future, as well as the new stuff like Harry Potter and hopefully Moon, a film certainly on my planning horizon. If you've got other suggestions of things you'd like to do, please just send us an email or drop by the website at vfxshow.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Really appreciate it. Goodbye.